checked in to give me a quorum.
We have a lot to do, and
we got the quality people here.
Not sure the mics are working yet.
They're working. Hello, looking here.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, that.
You see, the bills are all no good. What kind of report is that?
Anyway, I want to welcome you to the second in a row meeting of the licensing subcommittee. And I'm sure the members will be as enthusiastic as you are in a few minutes when they wind up. Anyway, let me tell you what the plan is here.
See the nurses here?
Yeah, because actually there was an omission on this on the agenda. There's a 2359 on the agenda.
I think I got left off.
We intend to address that bill today too. Let me tell you what we're trying to. Everybody's here. This is great. What we're trying to accomplish here is to deal with. 8 or 10, they keep multiplying, relatively technical and non-controversial modifications of the professional licensing statutes. At this point, there's no licensure going to be in this bill. But we are going to be using the health department didn't really offer, but we sort of, actually they can commandeer stuff in times of emergency. We thought this was an emergency. And we wanted to commandeer their licensing bill, House Bill 2175, and so we deemed it to be of a good nature. That's supposed to be a joke. And so we're going to be using that as a vehicle for all of your bills. And the Senate has agreed, as I understand, and so that will make it simpler, and you can just follow one target, and it's much simpler for the transactions. It's my desire that there's nothing that's going to require too many hard votes to kill or keep in along the way, although who knows what kind of things may go along, but that's my desire. Everything can't be worked out all the time. The procedure for today will be that we're going to hear, hopefully all these will at least pay a little bit of attention to determine if they're indeed really controversial and need to spend more time, or at least one group we're going to send off to go work out some things and come back in a week or 10 days when we meet again on this bill. But we're going to take a bill up, and there's almost everyone has an amendment, it seems like. And I hope all the amendments are in order. The staff has been working hard. What's that?
I don't.
Oh, you don't have any amendments?
No amendments.
There you go. Well, that'll move us along. Now, actually, these are all authors' amendments and already been worked out things. But we're going to take up the bill, hear it through, listen to questions. We'll hear a short presentation from the people who are behind the bill of the highlights and salient points that would benefit us. Did I say the word short? I said it 3 times, I know. Kind of succinct, if that's another way you want to. And then we're going to hear it, amend it, take questions to it to the satisfaction of the committee members, and we'll lay it over for inclusion in an omnibus. The omnibus delete all will be drafted for next time, or we'll just amend the bond, depending on what makes the most sense logistically. And then we'll address the entire omnibus. Although I would suggest if you have a concern about a bill that we're taking up, this would be a good time to express your concern. I won't be as enthusiastic to work with your concern. You bring it up the first time, next time. So, again, that concern could be expressed in a succinct way. If we can handle it, if we have an amendment that we can pass friendly, like we could do it today, otherwise we'll take it up later. At least we'll know. So with that being said, if the... why don't you come up now? Well, you're going to come and... We're going to actually jump around. We're going to move to House File 1988. I moved it up really just for you. So sit down. And Michelle, come up too. See, we work together here. We're going to. And why can't we be friends? We're going to do the podiatrist bill. And just to get it before us, I'm going to move House File 1988 to be before us for inclusion in the omnibus. And there is one point of controversy about this bill, which you can point out. This is an example of people who are going to do a little bit of homework and they're going to bring back a report. And so, go ahead. go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Michelle Baird, the attorney and lobbyist for the Minnesota Podiatric Medical Association. To my right is Keith Hovland, who is the executive director of the Podiatric Licensing Board.
And I'm Mary Gilbert, and I work with the Medical Association.
Welcome.
I'm not going to go through all the sections of the bill because, Mr. Chair, you just asked what is the area that appears to be of concern.
Well, actually, if you could just give us, for the most members haven't seen the bill, so if you could kind of give us a summary of why you're bringing these changes forward. I mean, take as much time as you want, 2 or 3 minutes, just explain the substance. Most of these are relatively interesting. They're small projects and highlight, go through your bill and you have a little time.
So. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 1, Subdivision 2 is really the guts of the bill, which is a clarification, and I say that with all true intent to that word. It's a clarification that podiatrists can perform midfoot amputations and histories and physicals on their patients that are admitted to hospitals, surgery centers, to receive podiatric care. That is one area, Your Honor.
Thank you, ma'am.
Be careful. You're very honorable, Mr. Chair. that the MMA has indicated they don't have a problem with the midfoot amputations, but they do have some concerns and questions about history and physical. Just for your information, the Joint Commission on Accreditation of the Healthcare Organization, known as JACO, has a standard MS 6.2.2 that indicates that other licensed independent practitioners who are permitted to provide patient care services independently may perform all or part of the medical history and physical examination if such privileges are granted. So JACO already allows podiatrists, because they practice independently, the same as dentists, to perform histories and physicals. The problem comes in is where the hospitals and the healthcare systems then have to credential podiatrists, and one of the things they don't want to credential them on is histories and physicals. The podiatrists receive extensive education and training in their School of Podiatric Medicine for 4 years on histories and physicals, in addition to their 2- and 4-year residencies that is covered. And so a situation that would occur that a podiatrist would need to do a history and physical would be a patient on a Monday is diagnosed with some severe diabetic foot problem. By Friday, they're worried about gangrene setting up. By Monday, they schedule surgery. But a history and physical has to be presented to the hospital within 7 days of the surgery. In that emergency situation, there isn't time for the history and physical to be performed by the internist or the family physician. So in that case, a podiatrist would perform the history and physical commensurate with their residency training and their education in medical school. Another example would be the family physician has performed the history and physical, but the fax machine breaks down, it gets lost at the hospital or surgery center. You're there as a patient on Monday morning, ready in your pre-op for surgery, but the history and physical hasn't shown up. If there isn't a resident in the hospital at that time to perform the history and physical, the podiatrist, commensurate with their training and education, can endorse the history and physical that they knew was already performed. In any case in which there were any major healthcare issues, such as coronary issues or some significant major medical illness that a patient would have that is non-podiatric, the podiatrist, as the same with a medical doctor, won't be performing the history and physical.
You can move to the next part of the bill. So
yes.
This is your meeting you're going to have. So this is the controversial part. Which
that's
would be
the controversial part. I don't know. Did you want me to add at this time?
Not yet.
Okay.
Just tell us your
point. The other subdivision, Section 2, Subdivision 1C, deletes a PM Lexis, which is the national clinical exam that podiatrists have been taking for a number of years. In 1986, we amended the statute to require that test, but since that time, podiatrists performed 2- and 4-year residencies, and so the material and information that is covered in the PM Lexis is duplicated, meaning it's already covered in the residency program, so it's a test that is not needed, and it's being deleted from the requirements. Subdivision 1C moves all references for passing scores on the National Board exam to the statutes, and so It also defines what a passing score would be. Section 2, Subdivision 1E consolidates the requirements for the jurisprudence quiz and the appearance before the board into the statute, and it deletes the references of the rules. Subdivision 3B and E clarifies the continuing education requirements for applicants that are licensed in another state. And Subdivision 2C moves the additional item listed in the rules to the statute so that all grounds for disciplinary action are put in the statute versus incrementally in the rule or statute. And under Subdivision F, it deletes related references in the rules and consolidates the reporting requirements for insurance companies in the statute. And finally, the other major provision is that it adds a confidentiality statement to the immunity reporting section of the statute. And it makes it consistent with the provision that is in the medical licensing board and also the board of dentistry. That's the essence of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Mary, you solemnly swear you'll go talk and we'll work it out. And if you don't, we'll decide. So how's that sound? And I appreciate you coming. Do you have any comments you wanted to?
I think Michelle Barrett spoke to that, Mr. Chairman. I think the cases we're talking about are the ones where there's very complex medical conditions. Diabetes is a good example. Because of general anesthesia, you can't have food prior to that. We want to be careful about what the insulin dose would be. The issue came up because the orthopedic surgeons don't even do their own histories and physicals, and so that's the issue that we want to address.
And I know there's some common ground, and so if you can bring us, if you can agree to language and bring us agreed to language, I think that we'll consider that. And then if you get close and can't agree, then we'll have to decide something. Just let it give us some notice about how it's going. Yeah. And any members have any questions? Thank you. The bill is the rubber for interim work.
Thank you.
I just want to announce, too, that we're out of here by 4:30 because there's a caucus. So you're dismissed. Thank you. If the I'd like to take up just now in case lightning strikes. I need to take care of Mr. Vanderveer's problem. We're going to take up number 12 on the agenda, House file. And if the alcohol and drug counselors want to come up and get ready to do their thing. We'll follow the agenda pretty close. But House File 2277, there's an amendment. Is that
2277?
Oh, that's the licensing bill, but there's the 21. There's the Vanderveer
amendment. Yep. I have the Vanderveer amendment.
How would you pass that out? We're just going to take this bill up. I'd like to move House File 2277 to be before the committee. And this is a. We're going to discuss this bill at a different time. But this is an amendment that Ray Vanderveer has been working on, Senator Representative Vanderveer, with his adult foster daycare. It's a work in progress, and to get the bill in order, he needs it to continue his interim work. We're going to offer this amendment, and if there's no objection, I'd like to move the amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. That's done. And so that bill, which is a very important bill, has 70 sections, I think, still, maybe 71 now. We might revisit this at the end of the day if there's another amendment ready to put on it. The reason I'm doing this now and so quick is so you can all look at it and see what we did and see how it affects you, and that'll be the best way to handle this. This is a controversial matter about some work that was done last time with capacity. Come on. Up here. And is the amendment, is there... 1125.
Yep.
It should be what we're doing is for the purpose of today. I'm going to move House File 1125, which is actually a bill that we incorporated in the omnibus last year. There's a bleed all, which is your language. And so to put in the order that will be appropriate today, I'll be moving the delete all amendment, which you will describe for us. This bill will be jacketed so that it'll have the benefit of being seen by whoever cares about such things. I'll have a week or so to look at it and offer their comments to you. So welcome to the committee, and would you please describe the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Todd Iverson. I represent MARCH, which is the Association of Drug Alcohol Counselors and Providers. Last year, we passed a relatively sweeping reform of the licensure law with regard to drug and alcohol counselors. When you do that, there's always a few things that are left out and not thought about. and this is really a cleanup. There are three provisions within the amendment, as I understand it. One provision deals with letting school district employees come under the same grandfathering provision that county and city employees did. Second provision deals with allowing folks that have let their license lapse apply for a temporary permit as they get their permit back in order in order to regain their license. And the third allows for the department to prorate out their fees. They are truly technical in nature, all three of these provisions. I don't know if anyone opposes them at this point, and if you have to stand for any questions.
Members have any questions? Staff questions? I'd like to move the bleed all. Any discussion about that? Representative Wilkins?
I'm just looking through at the school district requirement. Are the school districts all in agreement on that, or
Mr. Iverson? School section, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkins, the school section of MARSH asked to be included under that provision so their employees could take advantage of the quote-unquote grandfathering provision of the licensure law. We give county, state, and city employees, probably should have done school district employees, just didn't think about it. And so they're the ones that brought this request to MARSH to be included in that grandfathering period.
Who's Mr. Chairman? Who's they? I mean, is it
Mr. Chairman,
administrators, the school board association?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, it's the school section of MARSH, which are the folks that do drug and alcohol counseling and treatment in school districts. This would allow them to access the licensing procedure that we passed last year. Become licensed alcohol and drug counselors.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any more questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Okay, thank you. That amendment's adopted. That's laid over for inclusion. And if you have concerns that you think of in along the way, if people just conjure up some concerns, Department of Health, I'd left you. Would you like to come up now? Talk about your bill. We're going to take up 2175, which is the Department of Health vehicle bill. I didn't mean to skip over you. I was so excited about commandeering your vehicle. It was, anyway, if you do have concerns that you think of afterwards where people do, please bring them to me and we will resolve them. Just to bring the bill for our committee, I'd like to move House Bill 2175. Mr. Hindemeyer, welcome to the committee. You have a couple of different topics in your bill. Soon to have more, I understand.
And I hope the wheels are good on this.
Heavy duty suspension, Mr. Hindemeyer. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'm Tom Hindemeyer, Director of Health Occupation Program in the Minnesota Department of Health. This is our housekeeping bill affecting two occupations that we regulate, speech language pathologists and audiologists. That's one group, and occupational therapy practitioners. Last year, the legislature converted the registration system for speech-language pathologists and audiologists to licensing, and the provisions that are changing that statute that are in this bill are addressing various omissions and internal conflicts that occurred in rewriting that law. In addition, we are making some efforts to address deficiency in the continuing education area where individuals have, by the statute, 2 full years to get the continuing education requirement met, but the reporting date is the same date as the end period for that time, and we want to give people an extra month to get their report in if they are using 2 full years and not submitting their report at the same time they renew their license. We're doing the same thing in the Occupational Therapy Practice Act, where there's that internal conflict in the regulations. I think I'll just leave my summary at that, unless there are particular questions about some of the changes that we see.
Members have questions? It's going well. Should we quit while we're ahead, I suppose. Seeing none, I will lay House File 2175 over for inclusion. All right, let's take up House File 1919. So I'd like to move House File 1919, and I believe there's an amendment. And just to point out, House File 2359 was left off the agenda. We intend to talk about that today. It was we're getting some copies made, so that'll be up in there somewhere. So, welcome to the committee, Mr. Uday, and we'll introduce yourself and.
Mr. Chairman, my name is O.J. Doyle, and that is for and Physician Assistance. The young lady to my left is the president of my
welcome. Thank you.
I found a mail and folder with some information that I thought you might find useful. And what's in there is, that, first of all, a three-page piece of information on what is a PA, just in case you're not familiar with who we are and how we function and that sort of thing. And then there are two pieces of information that deal with the two things that are in our bill. Should probably the first thing happen is...
You make the amendment first? So yeah. Do you have it written out, or should this just strike a section?
It's handout.
Okay, there's an amendment.
Yeah.
Does the members have the amendment? Why don't you explain the amendment to us, Mr. Doyle?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the amendment deals with be found on page 3. You'll see the new language on lines 20 through 22. It deals with administering anesthetic agents in the emergency department. We've been working with the Nurses Association. There are some concerns on this that we wanted to respect, and so we just asked if we'd like to pull out that section and we can meet with them over the interim and see if we can come to
it. And if I can just comment about that, I think that's a good idea. We had actually quite a bit of testimony yesterday about the opt-in, opt-out, which kind of deals with kind of the gaps analysis in this thing. And I think if had you drafted it more like we discussed, I mean, just what you're after is emergency use only. I don't know what the need is, and I don't know if anybody... What the question to clarify is there a time when you haven't got an anesthesiologist available or a nurse anesthetist and you wish you could do something? And so that's the... And so when is that time in an emergency basis when you can't get him somewhere and so that's your condition? Is there a gap in the practice in the state where we just don't have that service available and if he is the appropriate person? That's your homework assignment that you need to clarify, I think, and that was the intent of that. Is that what you were...
Yeah.
Did I restate what you said accurately?
Yeah. You just perhaps don't have enough information that can be clearly laid out in the full ramifications are in the emergency departments, and we also wanted to make your bill less...
I don't mind complicated, Mr. Doyle, but if it's a better bill for it, I'm happy, and it's not ready for prime time just yet. So any members about any questions? Yeah.
So the Nurse Association didn't want the PAs doing anesthetic, is it?
Mr. Doyle.
Basically what it comes down to?
Go ahead.
Well, the history on it is that back in 1995, the rules that we were governed by were placed into statute. The CRNAs, as represented by the MNA, put a restriction on the ability of PAs to do anesthesia. And there are places in Minnesota where the PA is the most qualified person, where the CRNA is either not in-house, if it's after hours, or they might be doing a surgical procedure, so they're not available. So the PA has the training, has the education, has the experience, and is doing rapid sequence intubation, is doing what some people would term anesthesia for certain procedures that need to be done in the patient's best interest. Part of the question is, are we defining anesthesia differently than other people are defining it? And is what the PAs are doing really anesthesia or is it not? And so we were attempting to clarify so that nobody was going to be acting outside the law, and it created quite a stir.
I think it's I think it needs a little bit of work yet to be ready for export. So any more questions about it? So we're taking off for today.
I'm getting confused with all the blurring of the lines of all the professions. The anesthesiologists don't want the CRNAs doing it. The CRNAs don't want the PAs doing it. But they all...
Yeah, I think you're exactly...
Interesting dynamic.
It's an interesting dynamic. So for the purpose of today... I'll move the amendment, and seeing no more discussion, all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? There being one aye and no nays, and it's adopted. And the bill's in the order that the author would now like it to be. Mr. Doyle, anything else you wanted to comment about? But did you discuss the rest of the bill?
No.
Okay, why don't you discuss the...
Can you do that now?
Yeah, please, now, if you'd address the bill as amended.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, my name is Beverly Kimball. I'm a physician family practice PA in Forest Lake, Minnesota. I'm also, as OJ pointed out, president of the Minnesota Academy of PAs, and thank you for hearing our bill today. There are the packets which you've just seen, and you have the revised version of House Bill 1919. There are two objectives left in this bill. The first, which we address kind of the why and wherefore in this piece of paper that you look out in the packet, is to remove the requirement that a physician assistant have a job prior to being granted registration. In this handout, as you will hopefully at some point in time have a chance to read, in the original rules, again, under which we were regulated between 1987 and 1995, the process of registration did not require that you have a job. When the rules went in the statute, that inadvertently got switched. It wasn't an intentional switch. It just sort of happened. To the best of our knowledge, there's no other profession in Minnesota which requires employment as a prerequisite to being recognized or regulated. And indeed, the vast majority of the other states do not require registration or licensure, which is what's called in most states as a requirement for, do not require a job as a part of the process of becoming regulated. Employers will presume, and there is a flyer that looks like this in your packet as an example, that if you are registered before you apply for a job. If you look at the very last paragraph in this flyer, it says qualified applicants must have current registration to practice as a physician assistant in Minnesota. If you don't have a job, you can't be registered. If you can't be registered, you can't get many jobs. So it's kind of a catch-22. So what we're suggesting is that the fact of being employed be removed from the process of becoming registered. You'll see in Section 3 of the bill that the practice setting description and the supervisory agreement still would have to be completed prior to actually starting to practice medicine with your supervising physician. Before I move to the second part of what's in the bill, perhaps if there are questions about that rather than confused.
Members have questions?
See.
Okay. The second objective is to allow the supervising physician to delegate to the PA the option of ordering or performing radiographic procedures. Prior to the Department of Health rule, I believe it's called Chapter 4730, which was enacted in 1997, there was no restriction on the supervising physician delegating these activities to the PA. But in 1997, things changed. And again, as you can see in the second handout, which looks like yay, there is a national move going forward to exempt PAs and nurse practitioners as well from the requirement for special training. Minnesota law currently exempts physicians, dentists, chiropractors, and podiatrists, but does not exempt PAs or NPs. So we believe that it's appropriate for a supervising physician to be able to delegate these functions to the PA that's working with them. And again, I would point out, as with all duties that PAs have, everything we do is a delegated authority. So if the legislature sees fit to pass this bill as it is before you, that doesn't mean that automatically PAs have that authority. It means that the supervising physician can now delegate that.
Members, I just want to remind you that the PA authority, just to reiterate, it's been gradually increasing as we've become more comfortable with the kind of work that they might do. Last year we gave them the authority to do a temporary hold, I believe, and these are, I think it affected probably five PAs who were deemed to be competent there by their overseeing position. So, any questions about the bill? Seeing none, I'll just lay this bill over for inclusion. Thank you. Appreciate you coming by. Next bill up before us is the House Bill 1938. And I think there's an amendment to this. Is it a deletion? Speech pathologist assistance. And in your package, you have a delete all amendment, I believe it's. Just to welcome, we took your advice on this matter. There is no licensure or registration.
Yeah? What was that?
Well, it was, they were looking at registration. Now they're just establishing a bar with no credentialing. So.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's a good country, Representative. Should we just vote while we're ahead? Maybe we should describe it. Why don't you describe the bill? Or maybe let me move the bill to put in order. It should be in. I've moved House File 1938. I'd like to move the amendment. Just to put in order, we should discuss it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendments adopted. Welcome to the committee. Please describe what we just adopted. Is it illegal?
Mr. Chairman, Corey Battery is representing the Minnesota Speech Hearing Association. House File 1938, as originally introduced, was requesting the certification of speech-language pathology assistance. As has already been expressed in talking to legislators, it was advised that our association could achieve our goals without actually being regulated through the Department of Health and laying out everything there. So we took that advice, and that is reflected in the 2010 amendment that scales back our original proposal. We are not asking for certification, registration, or licensure. We are now requesting the ability to delegate duties currently within our scope of practice to a speech-language pathology assistant and find the training, use, and supervision needed to utilize these individuals. There is nothing currently written in law or rule that allows us to delegate duties to a speech-language pathology assistant. Speech-language pathology assistants are support personnel who would work under the direct supervision of a licensed speech-language pathologist and would include work in settings such as hospitals, rehab centers, and clinics. South Central Technical College in Mankato currently offers a two-year associate degree as a speech-language pathology assistant, and there are an additional two schools in Austin, Rosemont, that are considering adding a program. Minnesota is only one of eight states that does not regulate or have some sort of guidelines in place for speech-language pathology assistants. Mr. Chairman, if you would like, I could walk through the amendment if you would like it. That kind of summarizes the objective.
Members have questions about this topic? Whoops, and Norris,
have a question? Just going to say it sounds reasonable to me.
Reasonable?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, with that endorsement, I think that we're ready to. You could try to talk us out of supporting it, I think, but if you quit while you're ahead, I guess, Representative Wilson, you got any thoughts? And again, to celebrate the moment of no registration?
Yeah.
We'll have a party in my office afterwards.
Okay. Well, seeing no discussion, we'll lay the spill over for inclusion in the omnibus. Thank you for coming forward. Thanks for enduring the long grilling we did to you today. If we could. We'll take up now House File XXXX. Dr. Spicer is going to come up here. This bill is barely, the ink is still being drying on this particular thing. I wanted to give a chance to bring forward. So did anybody who want to copy this amendment? This is actually a bill draft just on the way to get jacketed. And so it's not had the advantage of being out in the airways for people to look at it. And, but I think that we can discuss it, and if we need to, next time we meet, we'll revisit it again if that's necessary. So I do believe in the process. But if you recall last time, well, I'll let you. You just want to tell it about yourself? Okay, members, I will. Actually, there's not even a bill file here. So I'll just. We'll. For an informational hearing, we'll bring this before us to talk about the status of the Board of Behavioral Therapy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. my name is Dr. Larry Spicer. I'm the Director of the Minnesota Board of Chiropractic Examiners, and he's Interim Director of the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. This was a new board that was enacted as of the 2003 legislative session. What we bring before you today are just a number of housekeeping issues. As a practical matter, the board was not actually appointed until December of this year. And so following that, the board has been working at nearly warp speed to start its administrative functions and get its licensing down. But part of that has been the review of the previous legislation and noticing a number of just minor defects that we bring to your attention today for the purpose of repair, hopefully. On page 1, line 25, we're proposing the deletion of this particular procedure, mainly because it's somewhat redundant and unnecessary. The normal disciplinary processes are actually a function of Chapter 214.103, so the board would not need to establish rules to manage that process. On page 2, line 11, establishing rules and regulations pertaining to treatment of impaired practitioners. Actually, the treatment of impaired practitioners has already been contemplated by Minnesota Statute 214.29, which requires all the health-related licensing boards to either utilize the health professional services program or a program comparable to that. So again, it would be unnecessary to establish rules to manage that particular issue. On page, bottom of page 2, going over the top of page 3, one of the requirements for being licensed as a professional counselor is the proof or the submission of a 2,000-hour field supervised field practice to be able to continue your licensure. In this case, we know that we may be licensing people that have already had this experience, 2,000 hours of experience, supervised experience. And so we're merely adding the provision that if they've already had this field experience, they could submit proof of that and that would satisfy the licensure requirement, rather than taking a licensed professional counselor who's already had the 2,000 hours and making them have to go back and do another 2,000 hours of supervised field practice. On page 3, starting at line 9, we're proposing the deletion of those next three lines, 9 through 11, really because, again, it's a redundant issue. There is an inherent requirement of regulatory law that regulated individuals conduct themselves and their activities or professional activities in accordance with standards of professional conduct. Now, as a practical matter, the board is working on rules that will probably be incorporating certain codes of ethics. Perhaps, we don't know yet, but perhaps the Professional Counseling Association's standards of ethics. And lines 12 through 14, we're proposing the deletion of that mainly because it's administratively burdensome and in fact, unnecessarily overly burdensome to the licensee or the potential licensee. For a licensee to declare to the board certain areas of professional competencies, first of all, that's a highly subjective statement, even though they may have had additional training in certain areas. But to also, as part of their licensing application, have to tell the board how they intend to use their license, or they intend to use it to provide professional counseling services and population to be served, it's just felt by the board that there's really no value gained, no regulatory value gained by having to make that declaration to the board. On going over to page 4. It was believed, based on recent experience that we've seen in other areas in which licensure or some kind of regulation was established but the fee structure was not established up front, that those organizations or agencies have suffered fairly substantial financial difficulties in managing their board and getting well behind the eight ball. Therefore, we are encouraging the fees up front as part of the regulatory structure, so that as soon as we begin the licensing process, we can charge the normal application and other related fees as part of that. So we're proposing the fees right up front. And this has been done as a result of fiscal analysis on the part of the board. Down a little further on the bottom, starting on page 36, this is actually a phrase, the insertion of, or its equivalent following semester credit hours. This is really just a nod to the fact that not all university systems utilize semesters. Some utilize quarters and some utilize some other methods. So we want to be able to address whatever equivalencies exist as well. We will see that language peppered in a couple of places throughout this bill. On page 5, the board wanted to be clear in its understanding because of its initial requirement for a master's degree to have 48 hours of professional counseling experience, or up to 48 hours, and then requiring as part of its first 2 years in practice an additional 12 semester credit hours, and that's actually semester or its equivalent again, credit hours as part of the continuing education experience. The board wanted to be sure that it established the 60-hour cap, that it was not intended for there to be more than 60 hours, so that if somebody had more than 48 hours, let's say they have 50 or 56 hours or something of that nature, they would not then be required to go back and get an additional 12 hours, which would take them actually to the doctor's level when in fact it's a master's level license. Before I go on any further, are there any questions so far?
Dr. Spicer, I do have one. Just to back up a bit, the there's been some discussion in the leadership about of our the house about fees and balancing out budgets and so on, and new enthusiasm on the part of Ways and Means to scrutinize a few thousand dollars apparently. So, can you is there a fiscal note that shows how this balance that you could provide us
no.
with? It would come from you if we got one, right?
Sure. We are prepared to develop a fiscal note right away. Certainly, there was a fiscal note developed last year when this bill was enacted, and the fees that we have here that we're proposing here are very, very closely associated with the expectations of that fiscal note at the time. There have been some minor modifications as we've gained a little experience.
I think it'd be in your interest to generate one and show how closely it approximates that. So I would suggest it approximate it pretty closely if I were you, but make the numbers. That was your intention. So show us your math, and that'll and actually all the bills that we've heard. So there's a fiscal impact. You'll be asked to go about that, and our staff or myself will be requesting that of you. So, Representative Sanderson. Yeah. Oh yeah, please.
Back on the top of page 3. That has to do with the 2,000 hours of professional practice. It stated or has submitted proof. Will they be using 2,000 hours in there? Or is that a little more subjective?
Dr. Spicer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Samuelson, the expectation is that it's going to be the 2,000 hours. We also recognize, as a practical matter, that some of these people may have been practicing in other states for 15 or 20 years. It's possible that supervisors are no longer with us, that the community educational institutions may not be available. And so we make room for the possibility, I think remote, but nevertheless the possibility, that the proof may have to be an affidavit form.
Why don't you proceed then? Continue on with the tour through the bill here.
On page five, line 15, we noticed just a small error. The intent of this is starting at line 12. This is describing the transition period of the license. And it says for 2 years beginning July 1st, the board shall issue a license without examination to an applicant if the board determines that the applicant. And the previous language simply says satisfies the requirements in 148B.53. The problem is that in 148B.53 it requires an examination. That was conflicting language. So we wanted to insert the word otherwise to be sure that we were including all the other elements and not also the examination, creating a closed loop. On page 7. On page 7, we noticed that there was an inadvertent omission in the disciplinary section of the bill, an inadvertent omission regarding sexual conduct of the client. Of course, it's pretty well accepted that you can't engage in sexual contact with a client, and for whatever reasons, that simply did not get included in the bill, and so we're proposing that as an insertion. And down lower on page 7 also, starting at line 32. Last year, the boards collectively engaged in adding some language regarding the assessment of civil penalties to licensees. And they used kind of standard language that they used it amongst 6 or 7 or 8 boards. And they cut and pasted that in here. So now, as much as we are having fiscal and budget problems, I don't think it's appropriate for the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy to be able to find physical therapists. So, although it might help our budget.
Oh, yeah. I kind of like that.
We propose the deletion of that version of proper language. On page 8, we are again affirming the notion that the Board can refer a licensee to the Health Professional Services Program if there is some kind of impairment. And further down the line, starting on line 26, we are proposing the insertion of fairly standard language requiring the licensee to cooperate with an investigation of the board that is reasonably initiated, and that would include participating at conferences, the submission of documents, and it also includes, over on page 9, the requirement that if the client has not signed the consent permitting access to the applicant or the licensee, shall still be required to submit the records, but in redacted form. And finally, the proposal of the starting at line 10, the standard immunity requirements for a board member or staff that are operating under the sanctions of the board and within the reasonable confines of the board statutes and rules. And then we are also proposing an immediate effective date upon enactment. That's pretty much my summary. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thanks. I have two questions. We had talked in a meeting about the aid to the unlicensed mental health.
Is that addressed at all in this, or is that a separate topic?
No, it is not addressed in this, and it will be addressed in a separate topic. That's still under discussion.
Just for your members' information, the Board of Unlicensed Mental Health expires
June 30th?
This year, yes.
Yeah, June 30th. And we took a savings on that, thinking that this group might actually get a chance to look into that, but unfortunately the appointments that this new board that Dr. Spicer has agreed to head up, and by the way, you're doing a great job. It's nice to have someone with experience to look after this. It's a very important group that this counselor's, this mid-level counselor thing is a very important thing that is going to help many people solve some of their personal problems. But it was thought that that this group could oversee that unlicensed mental health practitioners thing some way or other, but I don't think it's going to be possible to do a good job of that, and so this member and others think that we should wait at least a year for that, and that's going to involve a fiscal note, and that's part of the basis of your work. But I think had the time and the appointments been more timely, perhaps that could have been possible, but I think it's not possible at all now. The other second thing that came up was the inclusion of the alcohol drug counselors, which we've talked to Mr. Iverson about that. And we were thinking about having the Department of Health come up with a plan to resolve the $1.2 million deficit in that fund. They do have a 10-year plan, I was told. And so it's all done, and so perhaps you can talk to the alcohol drug counselors and come to, perhaps it's fine the way it is. So they, but have that discussion. And
we have had ongoing meetings with the Department of Health that have been really helpful. We just probably haven't talked about that.
Right. And so maybe no change necessary, but it's, so work that out, and since we'll be hearing this officially the next meeting we have, then you can bring a report about perhaps both those things, and perhaps, will the department help you ready to address that unlicensed mental health matter by then, do you think? Can you work on that and let us know what you want to do about that? Because I think it's a whole, in terms of function, and it's also a little money problem. But we have so much money, what's another 100,000 amongst friends anyway? That's the joke. Do you want to comment about that, or do you want to just let that be a project to go work on? Welcome back to the committee.
The department is waiting for the governor's supplemental budget bill to see whether or not it's included in that bill, because it does have a fiscal impact. And as you said, the action taken last year took a savings for abolishing the Office of Mental Health Practice. So we won't have any further information until the budget is released. Supplemental budget is released, I believe, early March.
Oh, the budget. Okay, and the forecast comes out Friday, but the budget will be there. And so just if you can carry back to your department that this member is concerned, and I'm sure other members would be concerned about it too. And at least we need a transition plan to handle the gap, because that's enough said about that today. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Last word? Do you want the last
word?
The
department is also concerned about it.
So I'm sure, yeah. Here we are all concerned, serving the public good. Any questions for Dr. Spicer about this project? You're doing well. You can quote all your head if you'd like. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, actually, there's one. But you can stay here. We'll hear the one concern we have to offer. Welcome to the committee. If you can tell us who the heck you are, we'd like to know.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Psychological Association. we've been working on this bill for 6 or 8 years, to my knowledge. And we had amended, the Minnesota Psychological Association had requested the legislature amend the language revolving around licensing professional counselors a lot last year. We were very comfortable with the way the bill was drafted, and then at the last moment, on the last day of session in the Senate, they decided to change the name of the board from the Board of Professional Counseling to the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. When the bill was first introduced year before last, and I believe in its previous incarnation, the previous biennium, the term was supposed to be professional mental health counselor, when in fact not many or all of these type of counselors would be mental health counselors. So we asked that the title of the professional license be changed to professional counseling. I know Representative Abler and other members have thoughts of what to do with the board in order to help some other situations for other licensing groups. However, the psychologist, the coalition of licensed social workers, the marriage and family therapists, and the Minnesota Association of Psychiatrists, I don't know if I'm saying that wrong, I apologize, all would like the name changed back to the Board of Professional Counseling. If you look at the bill that's, well, the draft, since it's House File XXX, it actually says, relating to health occupations, modifying licensure for professional counselors. If you go through the statutes or session laws from last year, you'll see that their license is for a professional counseling license. We believe that the Behavioral Health and Therapy Board is misleading in regards to who these people are and the type of activity that they're allowed under their license to do. So it's our request, and I don't have an author to move this amendment today. Bill's not before us, so we'll work on that, Mr. Chair. But you did ask that I bring it before the committee.
No, I appreciate
so that.
So that
you understand and the members understand that there are at least four groups, and I think there will be a fifth, working on trying to change this name back. And then I guess in regards to some of your questions about financial issues, I understand, I don't know, but maybe we should ask Mr. Spicer, has the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy printed business cards and letterhead and those sorts of things? Would there in effect be an expense to go ahead and change this name? I don't know the answer to that.
Dr. Spicer, you have equal time.
Well, the short answer to the question is yes, Mr. Chair. The board has already started the purchase of all of its stationery and those types of things. I'm not sure that that's the biggest issue before us, however. I think that, as Mr. Killer has pointed out, there are a number of other boards that are involved here. In fact, the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, the current statutory language, contemplates the subsuming of other groups, including possibly marriage and family therapy. There's a report required for that, including the licensed alcohol and drug counselors, and, as you pointed out earlier, possibly the unlicensed mental health care practices. We also know that there are some other groups that are counseling in nature that are beginning to approach the board looking for an umbrella for licensure for themselves. So the notion that the current language contemplates a little bit more of a broad idea, that would be interfered with if the narrative of the name of the Board of Professional Counseling. As a result of that, I know that currently the thinking of the board is that they're in opposition to this particular amendment.
I appreciate that. And I wanted to have you, wanted members to hear both sides of this discussion. Just so you know, the current law is that alcohol and drug counselors come into the board July 1st of 06.
05, currently.
05. Oh, yeah, 05.
Proposing an extension.
That's 05, yeah, 05. And that's the discussion point about that. And the unlicensed mental health was targeted to go there as part of the grand thought of this whole deal, plus whatever features you have in mind. So members will be able to listen to the discussion and that's a pretty amendment today. But this will be able to discuss this and the time in the interim. Oh, I want people to know that, you know, fair notice about how things will be discussed, and you each have now the knowledge that this is a question. And any other questions about, thank you, Mr. Keller. Any other questions about the board or anything? We'll lay this over for the time being. Now, next bill, I'd like to move House File 2374, and this is, just a technical change. And members have questions, they can take it up. I believe it to be purely technical. This is simply to add a list one item on a list that's, where I think you have copies of the statute, where this treatment of the massage, oriental massage is already included as a thing that they can, that acupuncturists can do as part of this in the description of their practice and in continuing education. There's been a slight question about that. This just technically clarifies it. Any questions from members about this? Seeing none, that's that. The Dennis, House File 2377. Mark, Mr. Schrag, oh, Dr. Schrag. Is it Dr. or Mr.?
It's Marshall.
Thank you.
Badge.
Welcome to the committee, and we're doing pretty well here, and I
hope to keep it.
Yeah, you're going to keep it that way.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Schrag, and I'm the Secretary of the State Board of Dentistry. We're bringing forward a bill today that now has a number, House File 2377, and it is a bill that was actually originally introduced last year in another form, and was not heard by committee, but since that time we've had the opportunity to review our Practice Act and suggest areas for technical change and clarification of our Practice Act. I'll give you a brief overview just by section if you want. If you want to ask about specific language, and I'd like to address that as well. But the big picture is that we're asking for technical and paraphrasing language in a number of ways, repeatedly throughout the bill, identifying that the accrediting body is the Commission on Dental Accreditation. Organization that would provide the accreditation for dentists, for dental assistants and dental hygienists throughout the state and throughout the country. We also request in the bill that there be some positive language review and various other technical pieces that they really have. But not got a great impact, except that they help clarify exactly what it is that we intend to do and how we operate. When we get to page 4, 4 line 8, the specialty licensure piece that carries over from last year helps to establish a uniform criteria for licensure of recognized specialties. Currently, the language allows the board to license dental specialists, but only provides the language for us to do that in cases of fusiform and maxillofacial surgeons. And in order to make that more uniform and provide the opportunity for licensure of specialists in other recognized areas, we wish to make the change in statute rather than go through the rulemaking process to clarify that language. Then when we get over to page 9, 9, 12, the guest licensure piece. This is the only part of the bill that would have any fiscal impact at all. And that fiscal impact is negligible. Basically, what was established when guest licensure was introduced a couple of years ago was the opportunity for dental professionals from other bordering states to work at public health clinics in Minnesota to help address the access problem. And to make it easier, at that time, the decision was made to just establish a flat $50 fee for guest licensure per year. And in reality, that $50 fee exceeds by $15 the fee for dental assistants in our state to be registered for a year. So a dental assistant coming from North Dakota to practice in Moorhead would be paying the additional $15 to have limited registration rather than the full state registration that they're currently or that they would otherwise be entitled to. So we're saying with the language change to increase that to up to $75 charges in fees, and that would enable us to adjust those fees as necessary over the coming years. But specifically, what we want to do is decrease the fees that would be charged to dental assistants. And dental assistants are currently the profession with the largest number of people coming from from the Fargo area into Moorhead to provide the services for the Minnesota's access needs. On page 11, line 2-1, in the credentials section, basically what we're trying to do is clarify the criteria for credentialing. And then further, we on page 14, line 9, we address the credentialing of dental assistants in the state. Currently, dental assistants coming from other states go through a process that is different than dental hygienists and dentists. And the idea is to codify that process so that clear what is expected and what's to be done. Finally, with the overview on page 16, line 25, the Board of Dentistry proposes that anybody who is in active practice of dentistry in the state would be required to maintain some minimum level of malpractice insurance coverage. And that is a mechanism for us through licensure to be able to protect the public for that. Currently, the only action that we can take against a dentist who is harmed a patient is to take action against their license. With the requirement for malpractice insurance, we provide a required minimum level of malpractice insurance so that that individual could take private action and hopefully recover either fees that they've paid for poor care or else recover fees that would enable them to get corrective care. So that's the big picture, and if you've got specific questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Mr. Schrag, are you familiar with the amendment that was brought forward?
From the Minnesota Dental Hygiene Association?
Yes.
I was made aware of that last night.
Let's take that up now.
And saw it this morning.
Okay. No, we got this. What lobbyist? And just so you understand how we're going here, if I don't like to blindside people at tables with amendments, unless it's that time of year and we just have to move along, or if we're having a bad day. But if maybe if you would introduce yourself and explain the amendment, and then you can listen carefully and see if it seems sensible to you. And if there's questions, and if it can't be resolved in about 3 minutes, we'll hold it over for a vote in about a week or 10 days. Welcome to the committee.
We look at this language as just being sort of a housekeeping thing. If you look on page 6, lines 34 through 36, when we originally took our scope of practices statute, we purposely included the language that the institution that the dental hygiene program is in is also accredited by the government. So it's a different thing to have the dental hygiene program accredited by CODA, but also the institution should be accredited by the government, so that they're both accredited. They're just different bodies. And we just felt this language is more appropriate for the practice of dental hygiene than what I've got included in that. So it's just, we'd like to reinstate the original language and remove the new language. On page 12, again, it's line 17. Merely, in addition, we think it was maybe an oversight that it doesn't include the language that has graduated from an accredited, and really we're concerned about the dental hygiene program. I'm sure the dental program is important too, but mostly we wanted that the person who's applying for a license through credentials has graduated from an accredited dental hygiene program in an accredited dental educational institution.
Mr. Schrag, is that...
Sure. I think by way of response, I want to inform the committee that the development of the language happened over a long period of time in a number of public committee meetings, our policy committee, our executive committee, and our board meetings. And we've had representation from each of the professional associations and each of the professions that we regulate. So basically, I think conceptually, we're all at the same place. With regard to the specific language, I'm not expert enough to be able to say, yes, it makes sense, let's just go ahead and do it. I feel an obligation to go back to the committee as long as there is a little bit of time and reflect on this. And primarily because the recommendations that Ms. Hazen is making could impact what we were trying to do is make it uniform for assistant hygienists and dentists, the way that the language is structured. And so if we do this, and some of us talking about the educational institutions and not just the programs, then we may wish to do that to be consistent throughout. So rather than just accepting it on face value, I think I appreciate the concern, and I think I'd prefer to take it back to the board to the expert.
I'm comfortable with that, Mr. Schrag. Are you comfortable with that?
Yes, I think we can work together. I agree. I think it would be good to have the educational institution in all the language.
I think we can work that, and perhaps some. If you can let us know, one concern we have about licensure and standard setting is that sometimes people are fenced out when you establish a criteria or a credential. And if you could also just make sure that you're not fencing out some school that didn't happen to meet some criteria. It's a very good school somewhere that
there
aren't didn't meet
that we're aware
out.
Of in the state.
All right. Outside of this plan.
You can, you want to comment or you just want to go work on that too? Okay, well, thank you.
I'm sorry, one more issue that's been raised, and that was with regard to the educational requirement of having completed their education at an accredited program in order to get credential. And currently, the Minnesota Board of Dentistry does offer licensure to foreign-trained dentists, and that's not through the credentialing process, but it is conceivable that a foreign-trained dentist who has been licensed in another state would apply for licensure through credentials to Minnesota. And although there are not very many states that currently provide that option, that is changing. And I think that's another thing that I think we'll need to look at before we say, let's grab onto it and run with it.
That sounds fine. I think we'll just, this has been offered. It has not been moved. And so you've been able to bring forward your concerns. You're now going to go off and work on this and bring this back a consensus that will serve both of your groups and continue to what we're used to. Any other questions about the body of the bill?
Mr. Craig, what can you tell me about the proportion of dentists that carry malpractice currently and the proportion that don't?
Mr. Craig. I don't think that's fair. I don't have those numbers. Our understanding from discussions with the professional association and with dentists that we've been in contact with is that the vast majority of dentists do carry that malpractice insurance. And what raised the concern for us was a couple of instances where we were trying to complaints from patients who have been harmed or alleged harmed, and where it turned out that those particular dentists did not carry malpractice insurance. I don't have a specific number, but again, I think that the majority of those dentists as business owners will carry that coverage.
I'm trying to figure out in my mind what kind of limits they have and what kind of awards would generally be in the dentistry area, since it seems like most dentists could absorb, you know, a fairly big chunk, and generally when you're working in that area, it's not going to be huge awards.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, when we first started discussing this a couple of years ago, we again went through the public meeting process, and at that time we were proposing that there be specific malpractice coverage, whether it was $1 million, $3 million coverage that would be carried. And one of the dentists who came to a meeting said, although he supported the idea of having some level of coverage, as you indicated, the amount of award that was granted for malpractice cases was not a high amount, and that they were concerned that if we set a minimum standard of $1 million coverage, that would automatically increase the awards up to that $1 million. That was certainly not the intent. The intent is to make it right for the patient who is now. And so we decided specifically not to set a minimum level. As far as the range of awards, over the last 3 years, the largest award was $155,000 that came to our attention. And the lowest was in the $4,000 to $5,000 range. So up until that $155,000 award, we were seeing the average the average award being around $14,000 to $15,000.
So
we're going to lay this bill over.
Any further discussions or questions on this?
You got some homework to do.
I'll lay the bill over. Thank you, Mr. Craggy.
I will take up House Bill 2359. I apologize. This wasn't in the. Come on up, Shirley. This was not put out in the deal. And if there's an objection, we're not voting on the bills today per se, except we're hearing them. And then, if it's all done, this is just left off the list. I don't know how we could have done that, but I. So you're here, and you happened to stop in, so your timing was good. I'm glad I didn't have to describe the bill myself. Otherwise, it would have been a good discussion. So I'd like to move House Bill 2359 for consideration. And if there's an objection to this, I'll apologize, and we can take up some more action on this next time as well, just to be properly notifying the citizens of the state who have an interest in nursing topics. So welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But this bill really has two parts. The first part is that it eliminates one of the requirements for graduate support nursing programs who are seeking licensure in Minnesota. The elimination is to do away with the requirement that graduate support nursing schools take what's known as the clinician and graduate support nursing schools qualifying examination. That qualifying examination actually is a predictor exam to address how well they may do or might do on the national licensure examination. All of the other requirements would stay the same. The credentialing review, the review of their educational program in that foreign country, and the requirement that they must pass the licensure examination. The benefit to the benefits are really to many persons, including the graduates of foreign nursing schools, because the test is offered very infrequently throughout the country. It's very expensive, and there are instances when it is in fact canceled because of a lack of number of individuals to sit for it. By eliminating that sort of bottleneck in the process, individuals will be able to become licensed more quickly. That will get more nurses into the workforce. And right now, there really is an influx of foreign educated nurses that are seeking licensure in the state of Minnesota as well as across the country. It really would also deal with an underemployment issue for those immigrants who have the qualifications. They've met the educational requirements and everything. They just have to wait for this exam and predict how well they're going to do on the exam they really have to take to become licensed in the state. The second part of the bill incorporates authorizes the board to be able to charge an administrative penalty fee to advanced practice registered nurses who let their national certification expire and continue to practice. Right now, the only way to deal with those individuals is through the disciplinary process, and by that, they usually end up with a public document, which is a reprimand and a civil penalty on their license. About 5 years, I asked the board to impose an administrative penalty fee for registered nurses and licensed practical nurses whose license expires, they continue to practice. They're competent individuals, they just didn't take care of the licensure process in a timely way. And what they do now is they pay a penalty fee for each month that they practice beyond that expiration fee up to a certain point. It can't go beyond 24 months. If it does, then they get kicked into the disciplinary process. But it really is sort of evening out. It's imposing a similar kind of penalty for advanced registered nurse lapse of national certification. And it also is making the consequence of that action really more appropriate to what the action is. So those are the two items in the bill.
Thank you. Any questions, members?
Mr. Chair, in regards to the advanced practice, are there a lot of advanced practice nurses that fall into that trap where they don't renew their certification?
Ms. Beckman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stemlinson, the numbers are fairly small that we know about. In Minnesota, there is the requirement to practice as an advanced practice registered nurse is that you must be licensed as an RN in Minnesota, and you must hold national certification in the specialty area in which you are practicing. It's not an additional licensure. It's simply a registry for that national certification. So what the board knows about are the ones the board deals with, not the ones that the board doesn't know about. I could tell you that in the past year, we have dealt with, I believe it is, 6 individuals in the disciplinary process whose certification has lapsed.
That sounds like a bill.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And is there other questions on the bill? Thank you. This will be addressed a bit later, but I thank you for giving us the content now. This bill is laid over. The final topic, we're going to revisit. I'd like to... we're going to take from the table House Law 2277, which is a VHS bill. It's not quite large enough yet. This is the Otto Norin or Norin Otto, I don't know, amendment. And we have exactly 4 minutes to state your case and pass the amendment onto the bill. So we have to leave, some of us are leaving early. Just for the knowledge of the public, who I'm sure is all watching at home on their TV set, probably not since we're not on TV, but listening to the tape later on, the DHS bill will be discussed in much more detail at a later meeting. And so I'm very comfortable with putting anything on it now just to give it a chance of public discussion, and that's my intention in this bringing this amendment forward now. So if you should identify yourselves and tell us about what it is you're trying to do here, please. And I'll move the amendment. So it's before us. I move House File H227A1.
Mr. Chair, my name is Nicole Otto, and I represent the Minnesota Rehabilitation Coalition, and we're going to be looking today to explain the amendment that's before you. And I just to preface everything, we've talked to several divisions of the Department of Human Services about this. We've talked to two or three different county associations. We talked to consumer advocates. We talked to other day training and rehabilitation providers to believe that everybody is okay with this language. So I'll let Lynn explain what it does. The amendment addresses three areas that we identified that we wanted to bring, where we wanted to bring statute into compliance with or into conjunction with what the current practices in the industry. And the first area is that most programs serve a lot of people on a part-time basis. And currently, the statute really is written to just describe the license capacity as the number of people you totally serve, whether or not they come every day or for a few hours a week. And so the change is made to really just reflect what's going on in the industry and make it more flexible and account for people that are served on a part-time basis. And the second area that is addressed is really just staff ratios and other parts of the rule that is not in statute. And these were left behind when the consolidated standards were developed a few years ago, which are the licensing requirements for all kinds of providers. And this old section of 038 remains as a rule, and so we're just moving it in with no substantive changes at all. It just moves that current language into statute.
It makes it easier for folks to find it.
And the last area, really, the need determination process is really a partner in the whole license capacity area. And so it takes a look at the need determination process, and it just has it work to define what entity or companies might be in the future. So that's very simple.
That's the whole amendment. Any questions for members? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment to be acted on for the time being, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Amendment's adopted. This bill is one of the best parts about this base bill that's here is that we're tweaking a recodification, which is if you think recodifying a section of statute is the ultimate, no, tweaking the recodification with technical changes. And many of the pages of that bill are that, and so I want to thank Hicks has had a good that. I'm sure Ms. Benelli has been helping out, but it's a work of policy art.
I want to thank the staff. We've gone through 10 bills in an hour, and that's very good in the part of Obey. 11, excuse me. And the the staff, I want to thank you very much for that. You did a lot of good work if you get your homework done ahead of time. I think this process allows for the debate we need and this quality of the subcommittee. So with that, we're adjourned.